Adam here from Day One. Just a quick message from one of our sponsors. Standard Ledger is your trusted partner for end-to-end financial support. They provide core accounting services plus expert financial guidance when you're ready to scale. Whether you need help with bookkeeping, payroll, R&D, or even fractional CFO services, their team supports founders across Australia to manage finances, raise capital, and grow their businesses. Visit dayone.fm/standard today to book your free chat. Let me tell you about our partner, Teamified. If you need to build a top-notch team quickly, Teamified is your go-to solution. They not only provide fractional CTOs, they can also do contractors and even remote team members tailored exactly to your needs. And whether you're looking for expertise in the Philippines, India, or Sri Lanka, Teamified has you covered. What's amazing is that Teamified uses a blend of AI and human expertise to cut hiring times by 50%. Their platform handles everything from automated onboarding to day-to-day management and even performance tracking. You can also handle rewards and recognition, buy equipment and order training all through their platform. Simplify your hiring process and get the best talent fast with Teamified. Check them out now and transform your team. Go to dayone.fm/teamified. That's dayone.fm/TEAMIFIED and get started today. Hi, I'm Adam Spencer, founder of the Day One Network, which is bringing the history of the Australian startup ecosystem to you. I believe in founders. It's why I do everything I do at Day One and our media company, W2D1 Media. And that's why the Day One Network exists, to create helpful content for founders. We've got some great shows in development, but a large part of what we do couldn't be done without support from our partners and sponsors. And I couldn't be happier than to be working with NTP, who get community better than any other technology recruitment company out there. A Newcastle company like mine, NTP are invested in seeing the growth of the local tech community in Newcastle, Sydney, and more broadly, Australia. So thank you, NTP, for helping us bring helpful content to founders and the startup community in Australia. Back to the interview. Hi, I'm Adam Spencer, founder of the Day One Network, which is bringing the history of the Australian startup ecosystem to you. I believe in founders. It's why I do everything I do at Day One and our media company, W2D1 Media. And that's why the Day One Network exists, to create helpful content for founders. We've got some great shows in development, but a large part of what we do couldn't be done without support from our partners and sponsors. And I couldn't be happier than to be working with NTP, who get community better than any other technology recruitment company out there. A Newcastle company like mine, NTP are invested in seeing the growth of the local tech community in Newcastle, Sydney, and more broadly, Australia. So thank you, NTP, for helping us bring helpful content to founders and the startup community in Australia. Back to the interview. Hi, I'm Adam Spencer, and welcome to Day One, the podcast that spotlights Australian startups, founders, and the organizations that empower Australian entrepreneurship. We go back to the beginning to tell the story of Australia's most inspiring founders and how they built their companies. You're listening to a special interview series as part of a documentary W2D1 is producing about the history of the Australian startup ecosystem. On the episode today, we have...
Hi, I'm Andrea Gardner. I'm the founder and CEO of Gelix Ventures. We're a Sydney-based venture capital firm that invest in early-stage Australian technology startups.
So before we just hit record just now, we were talking about, you know, founders raising funds and the fact that you have to raise funds as well. How do you go? What's your approach to that?
I suppose it's no different to anybody else's. I think the most part, first of all, we went to our existing investors that have been investing in our sort of syndicate business for the last 6 or 7 years. And then I suppose our major drive has been just asking those that are investing to introduce us to other people that they think might be interested in investing. We've got an interesting profile of investors. Most of ours are successful technology entrepreneurs, rather than sort of established family offices, which, you know, we've yet to really build great connections with yet. But what we did instead was really leverage our existing connections in the startup sector. But like any other startup, we've got a, you know, we have a pitch deck, we have a more detailed information memorandum as well to back that up. And, you know, where Ian and I do tag team, he arranges the, he gets the meetings and then I do the pitch and take them through the deck. That's really how we do it.
How, just out of curiosity, and, you know, don't answer this if you don't want to, but how many meetings would you have, would you go through to kind of get all the funding that you need?
That's a good question. We're lucky enough to have a really, really high hit rate. Really high hit rate. I would say the vast majority of people that we meet with will commit to investing in the fund. But just to put that in context, Blackbird had quite the reputation, you know, from going from, you know, had its 29 million fund, now they're the big boys with a billion under management. But for their $29 million fund, I understand they had something like 98 investors or 99 or something like that. And one of those investors invested $10 million. So that leaves the right 97 or 8 investors for, you know, $19 million. We're, I think, $24 million and we're already at 120 investors.
Right.
So we have an awful lot of 100K checks.
Yeah, yeah. Does that make it harder to manage from your point of view, having so many LPs compared to just a handful?
It's much, much, much more work.
Yeah.
And it's hard because we've actually got a small team. You know, we've got a new full-time investor starting in January. That makes us a team of 5.
Yeah.
And 2 of those are part-time. So it's a very small team to manage those relationships well. So our next hire early next year in sort of February, March, we'll be looking for 1, an ops person, and 2, a sort of community manager to make sure that we are actually, you know, managing those relationships
yeah.
as best as we can. Because at the moment, we're very, very stretched. And, you know, we're pretty proud of what we've achieved since, you know, the last year in particular. You know, in August the 16th, we did the first close of our fund.
Yep.
And since then, we've just agreed to the 10th investment this year, so we'll have closed 10 investments in the fund since August. So
congratulations.
It's been a huge amount of work. So it's to get those small but important things right, like your communications with your LPs and managing your investor relationships. It's important, but it's probably something that we need to focus more on.
Before we do go back to the very beginning when you first got involved in this whole scene, what do you enjoy most about your job?
That's an easy question. it's twofold. One, there's 3 big things. One, I think it's an absolute privilege to back the most extraordinary founders to try and make the world a bit better. Like, that really hits the nail on the head for me. It's intrinsically valuable, as well as, you know, you can generate strong revenues. 2, it's an absolute privilege to work with my small but amazing team. They are extraordinarily high caliber, and I just feel every day I feel so lucky to be surrounded with such incredibly high caliber team. And the third one is that I get bored really fast. The minute my learning curve flattens off, I get really bored and I don't function as well. But if I've got a steep learning curve, that excites me, and I, you know, I think that brings out the best in me. And given that it's a constantly steep learning curve for me, it just keeps me really interested and stimulated. And, you know, I have to learn about a new business sector almost every time I invest.
Yeah, that's
great. That's exciting. You have to get up the learning curve on the individuals. And it's a steep learning curve running a venture capital business. Not, you know, it's usually an apprenticeship model, and I've done it by the seat of the pants right from the beginning. But I've been very, very lucky that, we've got a really wonderful startup sector in Australia that is pretty, from what I can gather, especially if you say compare it with something like some of the stories you hear from Silicon Valley, we've got this wonderfully gratuitously generous community.
Mm.
So that people, the sort of top people in venture capital, like I don't know, Daniel Petrie and Rick Baker and Michelle Deaker, you know, all these people, Bill Barty, all these people are just have been so generous in just answering and responding to my constant barrage of questions. You know, what do I do here? You know, oh, what about this sort of regular, you know, there's so many questions as you grow.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've been really generous in helping me shortcut that learning process. So I love the fact that the community is just so supportive. And I suppose it's like any culture, I see it as being set from the top, and that we're very lucky here that the big boys and girls are good human beings. And they've set a great culture. So you've got, you know, good human beings like Mike Hannah-Brooks, who's really investing in a very meaningful way, not just financially, but his time and effort into combating climate change. And you've got, you know, people like you know, Michelle and Rick and all these people that are just good human beings. So I think they have been really meaningful in kind of setting the culture for the sector.
What amazing mentors you have.
I know. I feel that's, again, I feel really privileged. I just feel really lucky that they're, and just incredibly grateful for their just gratuitous generosity, because it goes so one way most of the time. Mm. Like, I'm not sure that there's much that I've been able to do to help them, but they've helped me enormously. And even to the point, you know, when the AFR, they were quite happy, you know, a lot of these people were really happy for us, like Daniel Petrie and David Shane and people like that, were very happy for us to use their names as having invested in our fund. Mm. And that was really powerful, because I think it took us about around nine months to raise that first $10 million that we're aiming for the fund.
Yeah.
Then the AFR published its article, and less than 2 weeks later, we had $22 million.
Wow.
You know, it was just...
Did the AFR get a commission on any of it?
Well, I have to say I'm very grateful to Paul Smith, because it was a really, really tremendously helpful piece of PR for us.
Yes. So let's go back now to the very beginning. When would you say you first got kind of exposed to the Australian startup ecosystem?
Well, we came here in 2002 to Sydney, and I don't think I was ever cut out to be a full-time mother and housewife, but I was pretty busy with little kids and feeling particularly understimulated. I'd been a, you know, investment banker and done stuff before, I suppose, that kept me occupied. And just out of interest, and I knew nothing about it, when Ian started Innovation Bay, he was a, for the listeners, we're married, but he's does have quite high profile in the startup sector. He also works half-time for Dulux now. Mm. But he started Innovation Bay because he was an entrepreneur, and there was really no other real structure around to facilitate the learning and networking. He didn't know anyone, and he was eager to learn. So he started Innovation Bay to provide these networking and educational opportunities for himself and then for other entrepreneurs in a similar boat.
Yeah.
And he, as you probably know, he ran it as a labour of love for about 15 years, but it's now he works half-time for Innovation Bay and half-time for us. But back then he started adding in these pitch event type dinners, which were, I think they very well might have been the first or at least one of the very early pitch event type, you know, the pitch events that were held in Australia. And so I used to go to those just out of interest. And after a while, there's this sort of pattern recognition. You kind of start to see the characteristics of those that go on to do well and, you know, those that don't.
Mm.
And then we saw Storage's pitch, Vanessa Wilson. They were the first to market with deduplication software for the cloud. And we thought, oh, my God, this is a huge technical problem. If they can sell this, it can save enterprises hundreds of millions of dollars. This is a really good investment opportunity, pre-revenue, pre the results of the pilot. You know, Ian was well connected enough that he could, knew someone that could actually test whether the tech really did solve this problem that some big enterprises had thrown a lot of money at and failed to solve.
Yeah.
So we didn't have a lot of money ourselves, so we wrote a very modest check ourselves, and then by the end of the day filled the allocation that we had. And two things happened. 3.5 years later, we returned 10x to our investors. And when StoreReduce was purchased by a New York Stock Exchange listed company called Pure Storage. But at the time, I realized that there was a big appetite out there for investors to access the asset class, but it was kind of crippled with fear of the unknown and the recognition that it's a really high risk asset class. Mm. Great potential, but it's a very high risk asset class to invest very, very early pre-revenue in these early stage tech startups. So I started Gilix to provide a much better sort of risk managed or hopefully risk mitigated way for investors to access the asset class. And so, because I'm a bit of a dot the I's, cross the T's person, and I have a previous life as a lawyer and, you know, big global debt capital markets transactions, you know, I like to do things properly, especially if, you know, I feel a big weight of responsibility when investors are following me. Mm. You know, they're making investment decisions basically based on having confidence and trusting my decision making. Mm. So I probably did pretty heavy due diligence, you know, probably more appropriate for Series A rather than pre-seed startups. But we've continued to do that because it is a really high risk asset class, and but the potential is enormous. And I think that worked really well to help build that investor base, you know, because it's all about trust and confidence in your decision making, I suppose. So, but it was an interesting way to start, having no track record and no money and no operational experience. But, you know, I was eager to learn. And originally, you know, the investors that were interested, they'd come in and they would want two and a half hours with me just to get to know me and get up that learning curve, that comfort curve with me as a person.
Mm.
And, you know, deal flow was good. A lot of that was because of Ian's high profile in the sector initially. It was all because of his very high profile in the sector, which we leveraged the wazoo out of. But, you know, we have built a reputation ourselves now, and we have really strong direct deal flow that you know, doesn't rely on him at all anymore, though his reputation is very helpful. We've now done, I think I've lost track because the cadence has been so fast recently, but we've done over 40 investments now.
Wow.
I think it's over 30 companies. And then we raised our first fund in August.
I would like to talk about the deal flow in a second, but two questions. Like, how is your law and investment banking background really helped you, but also move into being a venture capitalist, but also what is the biggest kind of surprise about starting a venture capital firm?
Great question. So I think the law and investment banking background, my whole professional career before this was in debt. I barely knew what a share was. Obviously I knew what a share was, but equity was not my area of expertise. But I think it helped my credibility, you know, that, believe it or not, having worked for Lehman Brothers in London, I think that helped my build confidence in me. And I think it's just that expectation of excellence in your approach to things and the way you did things. You don't cut corners, you just do things right or you don't do them. And I think that attitude has probably been helpful. And I think the other thing that's been helpful, this is a heavily financially regulated area. So the legal background, I suppose, in particular, made me particularly concerned to make sure that we're completely compliant with and no gaps type of thing.
Mm.
And I suppose the transaction management, you know, some of those basic skills and stuff. But I think the biggest surprise has been a complete delight. The biggest surprise is that, to sort of provide the context, integrity is a really big part of me and who I am, you know, my values. It's just really, really important to me is trying to always do the right thing. And I'm feeling a bit emotional now because I'm quite touched that that I've found that to be more highly valued in what I'm doing now with Geolix than ever in my whole career before that. And that's just, it's wonderful. I spoke to a branding person once, some marketing branding people said, oh, you know, you've got to work out who your customers are and then sort of target, focus your branding on them. And then I spoke to another one through Heads Over Heels. I've forgotten his name, James. I'd love to give him a plug because I thought what he said was spot on. He said, no, that's the wrong way around. What you need to do is work out what your values are and
attract the customers.
Get that message out there and then you attract the right people to you. And I think that's what's been happening. So we have, you know, our investors on the, you know, they seem to share our values and are attracted to us partly because of our values. And it's the same with the team and the talent that we attract and the founders that we attract. And that's just this wonderful luxury of having people with aligned values that on your team, in your portfolio and your investors.
How do you balance that commitment to not cutting corners, that integrity with having a small team, with punching above your weight, and I suppose being a little under-resourced compared to what your output is?
You've hit the nail on the head there. It's pretty impossible to balance. We've been able to do it so far because of the incredibly high caliber of my team with, you know, Alan Greenspan and Kim Hooper and Ian, obviously. But I think what's happened is they've just worked far too hard for the last, in particular since about July last year when things just took off like a rocket. And we're all tired. So, and it's not sustainable, but luckily we've got an awesome new investor, full-time investor joining us in January, Will Lee. So, you know, we're super excited about him joining us and that will help ease the pressure. And then, as I said, you know, now that we have a fund and we have that certainty of revenue, we're planning on hiring a couple more people.
That's fantastic.
In around March, April. You know, what the cost of it, as I said earlier, the cost of it is that, you know, some of the, I think just see some of the management of our relationships with LPs, which we seem, we and which we recognise as being really critical and really important, has probably not been of, we could do better. Mm. And we will get more manpower to do that.
I mean, I obviously don't have tens of millions of dollars under management, but I kind of relate in a way to, you know, interviewing 150 people, managing, you know, 20 partners for this series. I feel like I have dropped the ball in some regards as well in terms of relationship management, and I feel terrible about that. So I can relate a little bit to what you're talking about. What do you think some of the gaps are looking at today and into the future within the Australian startup ecosystem? Like, where can we make some improvements?
Well, I think to start, the gap, look, the clear, glaring gap that's growing is in the seed funding stage, you know, professional investing. So, you know, go back to the Blackbird example, started off with a $29 million fund, now it's got $1 billion under management. Mm. It must be pretty tough to write a check for $300 or $500 at seed stage now. Mm. And look, this has been across the board. I don't want to single out Blackbird, who I'm a super fan of. But I think if you've got $1 billion under management or $800 million, you probably, the sort of fund economics suggest that you probably need to be writing much bigger checks than $300,000 or $500,000. You know, especially if you think about if you're going to work actively on a board, each partner might work on, say, 4 to 6 boards. You're not likely to be wanting to work on a board that, you know, you've written a $300K check for out of $1 billion under management. The result of that is that I think that, and there's some good evidence in the AIC's last report that while there's a lot more venture capital funds under management in Australia, there's less professional investment going in at the seed and pre-revenue stage. And that's creating a growing gap in the market. And I think there's a very serious risk that will undermine the pipeline for these big companies. The big venture firms, which obviously ultimately has the risk of impacting on economic growth in Australia because startups are providing, you know, the big provider of jobs and economic growth. So I think that, that growing seed funding gap is something that would be good to do something about. I like to think we're doing our bit there. And it's a great opportunity, really, for us to leverage. So it's a good opportunity. The other thing I think that's happening in the market, it seems to have changed quite significantly by COVID, in that, you know, our original fund strategy was to, you know, write a small check and then you'd be very disciplined about not following on in those that don't do well, but because we're investing so early, but also, you know, triple, quadruple down in those that do well. But those that are really doing well, the competition for that is really hotting up. And even if the found you've developed this strong relationship with the founders and the founders really want you in the round, they are often having less power. And part of the power to make that decision when the big US, increasingly big US investors are coming in and competing for these deals and squeezing some of us out here. Or maybe not out entirely, but instead of quadrupling down, we're only getting a bit more sort of thing. A lot of that, I think, has been brought about by COVID, that the US investors that weren't comfortable not, you know, investing without meeting people. And I was the same. Pre-COVID, I wouldn't have dreamed of investing in a founder that I hadn't met. But since COVID, I've invested in plenty that I've only met over Zoom. And they're becoming more comfortable investing in Australian startups that are doing well over Zoom without coming over here. And so the competition's hotting up.
What do you mean by, you know, and this is going to show a little bit of reflect on how much I know about this space, the investment space, but what do you mean by them, the founders, not having the power to just let, you know, you quadruple your investment in them? How are you getting forced out?
So I'm thinking of one particular example recently. Yeah. I think the round size was, it's not completed or anything yet. So, but the round size, I think, was $6.5 million. The US VC was not going, a condition of its investment, an absolutely non-negotiable condition, was that they took most of that.
Right.
So there was a tiny, tiny slice of the pie to divide up between existing investors and those that the founder felt, you know, they wanted to look after.
Yeah. So it's just like
the founder has had the choice of, do I take investment from one of the top funds in the world that can have a massive impact, a potentially really game-changing impact on our business because they've helped take to market a business like this before.
Yeah.
They know how to help us scale it. They've got tons of resources in terms of, you know, HR, recruitment, strategic connections.
Yeah.
It's a massively valuable investor. I risk that for someone, you know, a smaller investor in Australia that cannot provide that kind of game-changing help. It just means that, in a sense, their power, well, I suppose they still ultimately have the power, but not in practice.
I've read a couple of articles, and you've said it in the interview here as well, about your amazing deal flow for GLeaks.
Yeah.
How have you managed that?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways. One, you know, there's that growing seed funding gap, and that's our focus. So, and I think we're well known for that's actually where we focus, and that's where we feel we can help the most. So there's that reputation. I think, you know, we do have a reasonably high profile for, you know, the size of business that we are. You know, originally kind of leveraged Ian's high profile, and he probably has, you know, he's got one of the highest profiles in the sector. I'm biased, but I suspect not, you know, I'm very biased, obviously. He's my partner in business and in life, but my guess is that most people would probably agree. And so that's helped. We have our own profile, I suppose. But I think also we have wonderful portfolio founders that talk to other founders, and they encourage us to come out our way. And when the founders come to us that way, they come kind of pre-sold. We don't have to sort of compete for the deal, really, because our founders have often done a really nice job of selling us for us, which is lovely. I also think that, you know, whereas further down the life cycle, you know, maybe Series A, B, the competition is hotting up, where we invest, because it's high risk, you don't really want to take the whole round or even 80% of the round. You want to spread your risk across many more investments. And so there's an awful lot of, you know, collaboration and co-investing. And, you know, we talk to each other a lot, you know, those that, you know, that we co-invest with. You know, and we co-invest a lot. We co-invest with Airtree, with Carthona, with Blackbird, Investable. We co-invest a lot and help each other, I suppose. Maybe that's unique to the stage we invest at, because it's in our interest to help each other, because we want to co-invest. Either way, I love it. It's really nice to work in that environment where everyone wants to help each other, and we're all aligned with wanting to help the founders.
Moving over in 2002, we're in 2021 now. I have that right? 2002?
Yeah.
Yeah. What are some of the biggest movements or changes you've observed in the ecosystem over the last, whatever that is, 20 years?
I think there's a lot more infrastructure to support startups. There's lots of incubators, accelerators, some have come and gone, but there's still around in different capital cities. There's actually communities in each of the capital cities around Australia. And you've got like the South Australian government, the Premier is really supportive of startups, and they're throwing lots of really helpful support to startups to attract them to South Australia because they know they create jobs. The Victorian government is as well. I know that they're, you know, they're even funded a fund of funds, which is really, I think that is a really powerful thing to do, because getting a new venture capital business off the ground, raising that first 10 million, most often without a track record, is really hard. But if you've got a fund of funds providing some matching funding, that I think will have a really big impact on helping get the capital that early stage founders need, because, you know, as I said, there's that growing gap there that the bigger funds managers can't, you know, that's not really their focus. And that's helping sort of grow the amount of investors that can actually invest at that stage. So I think that's a really good move. I don't think it's off the ground yet, but it's well on its way. And then I think we could do with that in New South Wales. And we've got, I think another really important thing is that you've got, what we didn't have back then was second-time founders reinvesting their time and expertise and money into the sector. And I think that's probably the biggest and most powerful and important change, is that we now have lots of second, third-time founders or successful founders that are reinvesting their time, their expertise, and their money into the sector. You know, you just have to look at Scott Farquhar, Mike Kenner-Brooks, and a ton of our investors. And, you know, we've got 700 registered investors, and a ton of those are actually successful founders. And so for example, when COVID first hit last March, April, not the last one, the year before, you know, I think I wasn't, unlike a lot of people, that I felt a bit like, you know, the coyote when the roadrunner had run by. You know, it's just sort of spinning around going, eek, you know, oh shit, what do we do now? How's this going to affect things? So what we did was we organised all these sort of Zoom calls with each of the syndicates that had syndicate investors with the founders that they, you know, of the companies that invested in, and did a big brainstorming session to identify the risks and how we might brainstorm how to mitigate them, identify any opportunities that might have been generated by COVID and how we might leverage them. You know, and I think 7 or 8 years ago, there wasn't enough people around to do that.
Mm. So congratulations. That was the very first Roadrunner reference in the entire series of 90 interviews. So that's amazing.
Shows my age.
I absolutely love Roadrunner. Huge fan. So thank you for that. And so these last two questions, I end every interview with these. And the first one is, what advice would you give a brand new founder that would help them succeed slightly? One piece.
One piece. Oh, God. Can I do two?
Yes. Yep.
Trust in yourself.
Yep.
Back yourself. They're already doing that, but back yourself. And then when it comes to raising funds, do your homework. like do your due diligence on the potential investor and on what terms look like and how they might impact on you later on.
So this last question, not really a question, but just a bit of a prompt. We, as you know, we're trying to create a documentary that will tell the history of the Australian startup ecosystem as well as we can, as honestly and wholly as we can. I want founders, investors, academics, policymakers, everybody from every corner of the ecosystem to listen to this story. What message, if any, do you have for them?
The politicians, I would like them to be, you know, look at the hard numbers of how the startup ecosystem is creating more jobs than any other sector in Australia and get behind it. You know, I think we've been terribly let down by the federal government, and I think the New South Wales government could do a lot more. But yeah, that's probably my main thing, is recognise how important it is and that it's much more important for the economic future of Australia than digging stuff out of the ground.
Thank you so much for your time, Andrea.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. More interviews are on the way. Follow the podcast wherever you're listening right now. Stay tuned for more interviews with many, many more amazing people from the Australian startup ecosystem. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.